Welcome back to Gentlemen Prefer Bonds. I'm Will Daniel.
And I'm Will Schlick.
And I'm Max Wilcox.
And we have finished talking about the James Bond movies for now. We're doing a little mini-series of some movies we like that are Bond-adjacent or Bond-inspired. Like, you know, movies like Agent Cody Banks or Agent Cody Banks 2, Destination London.
Yeah, 13 going on 30. all the classic, clearly Bond-related films that we know. Hitch.
17 again.
Stuck on You.
Yeah.
Stuck on You, yeah. Great Bond movie.
Me, Myself, and Irene. All the big ones.
I literally picked from some movies out of a hat, and we got Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery as our first selection here. I think I saw this movie at a sleepover, probably shortly after it had come out. Yeah, this movie was released May 2nd, 1997. It had a budget of about $18 million, made it about $67 million worldwide. Not a big hit, but it sort of became...
Home video, baby!
Yeah, graduated from cult movie to like mainstream success instantly. Was just a huge hit on VHS and DVD.
And DVD. It was one of the first big DVDs.
Yeah. And even the VHS I was reading had like a bunch of deleted scenes and had the alternate ending and stuff, which like was one of the first like videos to have like special features on it. When did you guys first see this movie?
I probably saw it when I was about 10 or 11. And speaking of DVD and home video, strangely enough, it was very obviously big on that. My uncle had it, and my younger cousin, who was only like maybe 5 or 6 at the time, just absolutely loved it. Yeah. I've probably watched this movie at least 10 times just with my uncle and my cousin alone, if not more, from a young age. So
we definitely both saw it before we'd get both a lot of the like specific Bond references, but like just all the sex jokes. We're like obviously giggling at a lot of vagina and stuff, but yeah. There's a lot of things also that you need to be a little bit older.
That's true. When we were still watching it, when I was in the 13 or 14 range, I started to get it a little bit more.
Yeah, I saw it. I definitely obviously didn't see it in theaters or anything. I probably saw it first, probably on TV or on video about the time the sequel came out 2 years later.
Yeah,
I would imagine that's
maybe the same for me. Yeah,
that's probably what it smartly is it's like that when it made enough money and was sort of big enough to be successful that then I saw it at that point. And I've easily seen that movie probably 20 times. Like I will jump out early and easy and say that I think this movie is perfect. I think this movie is amazing. I think it still holds up. I think this movie is an awesome movie.
It's really funny.
Call me crazy. I think I saw both Spy Who Shagged Me and Goldmember in theaters, actually. Which makes it even funnier to me.
Yeah.
What were they, 2001 and 2003?
No, I think Goldmember took a little while to come out, where that was 03. Spy Who Shagged Me was a quick turnaround. It was 2 years later in 99.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
It's obviously a spoof mostly of James Bond, but also just kind of like of the 60s, and it kind of does the Back to the Future thing of like the character from a different time not getting what it's like 30 years later or earlier. He's got of the other references besides Bond in it, obviously they're doing Hard Day's Night and in the opening. I forget what movie Soul Bossa Nova is from in the 60s, but they're taking like the theme of another old movie and making it, you know, what a generation of people now know as like the Austin Powers theme. They're taking Look of Love from the Casino Royale, along with, as we discussed in our second to last episode, they've got the like circular spinning bed from that. What was the other? And then he's a like fashion photographer, I think, just because Blowout is like another influential blow up for movie.
He had he had a quote when he was interviewed about it at the time, and he said that a lot of it was just related to his family and his dad and his love of when I say he, I obviously mean Mike Myers. And he said that the inspirations were in his words, James Bond, Peter Sellers, the Beatles, the Goodies, Peter Cook, yeah, and Dudley Moore.
Just his favorite parts of the 60s, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, I kind of wish it was just this movie. Like, it's a great comedy, and then the fact that it should have just been one great comedy, I think, because it turning into the kind of, like, cultural phenomenon that it was just made it so that, like, it just becomes this thing where every douchebag starts to do an impression of Austin Powers or Dr. Evil or something, and you're just like, shut the fuck up. Like, I used to like this, or I want to like this.
I think two is also very good, if not just as good as one.
I rewatched all three of them maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I had a rough time, frankly, with 2 and 3. But we'll talk about those soon. I'm sure.
I like both of them. Yeah,
I'm so, like, I get that Goldfinger starts to wear the joke. Or sorry, Goldmember. I get that Goldmember starts to wear the joke down. I think that two is a crystallization. I think that two takes sort of like this wide concept and is just like, it's a specification. I dig two. I might prefer to put on two than one on, really? Like a random night. Yeah, it's got Fat Bastard in it. He's great. it's got Mini Me. Like, it's so many things in it are beautifully ridiculous. It has the pulling stuff out of his ass, which is a better version of what they do in this movie, which is the pantomiming covering over dick and boobs.
I agree with that. The pulling stuff out of the butt in two is far and away the funniest part of that movie.
It's the better version of the same joke that they do in this.
Yeah, but everything else, I just feel like it's diminishing returns for everything else in 2 and 3, where they're repeating the same old jokes again and again. Anyway, we'll talk about 2 and 3 soon.
Bastard. Oof. but yeah, international man of mystery, Austin Powers.
Oh yeah. Obviously, we're referencing like From Russia with Love and Thunderball by showing Dr. Evil from like behind and his hands the first couple scenes, and then Thunderball with the people dying in the I guess not electric chairs but flames there. Just going through my notes, I wrote down electric psychedelic pussycat swingers club. Yeah. Just so fucking good. Great.
So good.
Oh, and the, like, I love him, and it's like You Only Live Twice also, where they've got the he has just like FaceTime in his car where he's looking at Michael York as Basil Exposition. I love his 60s hair. And it's actually like an analog, like, film thing, not a video thing that they're doing in there. They're like using all the 60s technology that would be in like You Only Live Twice or Star Trek for those. And I love the bad rear projection as they're driving in the 60s is really great. One of my favorite lines in the movie, that he gets in there to the club at the beginning and says, "It's my happening, baby," and it freaks me out.
I don't think that any film has had a better named character than Basil Exposition. It's one of those jokes that is so dumb that it wraps around and becomes smart again. The fact that exposition is already such a British ridiculous word that you don't have to jokeify it. It's a word that already sounds like an upper crust BS name. So his name is simply Basil Exposition, which sounds, if you didn't know what the word exposition is, which I didn't when I was 9 10 watching this, I just thought that it was a good British guy name. It's perfect.
When I was 8 or whatever, definitely didn't get that joke as well. Love the we're doing Thunderball again with punching a woman who instantly turns into a man.
That's such a good joke. Yeah.
And then when it comes back, it's just hitting the old lady later.
It's also one in a line of jokes, which, because when I said that I love this movie, I do. I think that 90, 95% of this movie holds up to today. It's one of those jokes that could have been troubling, but it isn't, because it is playing on the spoof of like male stunt doubles in older movies. Like, it is playing on a very specific joke and trope, instead of being like a really lazy, shitty trans joke. What he's saying is literally like, no, how did no one else realize that it's this man with a 5 o'clock shadow that's trying to kill me?
At the beginning, they're talking about how they did movies like Thomas Crown Affair do this like way overuse of split screens. So they'd have the eight squares in that one shot, or it's like, and pack the overnight bag and so feed my good. Fish, and just the hand dropping a little bit of fish food in there. And that guy's Charles Napier, who's like, you know, classic character actor. He's in Silence of the Lambs, Rambo, Blues Brothers. That's the American general, and love how he says London, England, and then when he's in the like freezer vault, and he says something like, after we had to bail you guys out after WW2.
Yep, WW2. He says WW so hard you think he's gonna say WWII.
Yeah. Do you think that the Matrix 2 years later stole the warm liquid goo phase from this movie?
See, I had a different take. My take was that a lot of the cryogenic stuff in a cool, fun way is all a play on Alien. Yeah?
I don't think they're
Alien
in,
slash aliens, because
goo in that. They're just like in a bed pod.
Yeah, but that she has like, coming out of it, she has like tremors and shit like that, right?
You know, I watched like half of the movie with commentary last night and today, and Jay Roach was saying, I mean, that could well be an influence, but what he said was that to him, he was mainly like riffing on, or he was kind of just ripping off Sleeper, Woody Allen waking up after hundreds of years.
Directorial enigma, Ray Roach.
Jay Roach, who made
these movies, the Meet the Parents movies, and then fell off the face of the earth.
Oh, he just made Bombshell, and he's making
he's all sorts of HBO stuff.
He's been doing a lot of political stuff.
Doesn't he? Nobody produces almost all that. He directed.
No.
You know, he directed all those.
Yeah.
He directed a couple of the political things, but none of them are good. Is also the point.
Yeah, I'd say none of them are great for me.
I mean, yeah, y'all's stunned silence sort of proved, whether or not you'd think you want to disagree with me, you didn't immediately jump out and say, you know.
I thought Bombshell was pretty good. I thought, did he do the Sarah Palin one?
He did, yeah, he did that one.
Yeah, I liked that. I mean, I don't know if and when I'll watch these movies again.
It's hard to say they're bad. I wouldn't say they're good either. I can't disagree with you if you don't like them.
All I'm saying is that you directed Austin Powers and Meet the Parents, which are two movies that are probably in a top 200 comedies, and then you did Recount and Dinner for Schmucks, where like your next two frickin' projects. Just a weird. Oh, like how many directors do we know that kind of go from like that level of success to like that level of down?
I feel like Adam McKay, you know, I know
sure is on that
people,
turn.
People have you know mixed feelings, of course, about Don't Look Up, but I feel like maybe ignoring that movie, he's sort of the market correction of Jay Roach to go from silly comedies to like. Still kind of funny movies, but with a political agenda.
Yeah.
I completely agree, but I think he might... But I think that Adam McKay does have more like...
To say.
Well, no, but he also just has... He has bigger... He's had bigger swings. Like bigger, better swings than Jay Roach, who has essentially two. And their various sequels of diminishing return.
Yeah, did he do the last Meet the Parents movie? What Little no, Fockers
did,
or something.
He did meet the parents and meet the Fockers, which are the two best of them.
Yeah, of the three, are the two best.
Meet the Fockers is relatively funny. I'd laugh.
So then my boss connection, they obviously did those movies together, the Meet the Parents movies, and then did Dinner for Schmucks together, so that he knows him quite well.
Fucking Dinner for Schmucks. Fuck it. Ay, ay, ay.
It's just, it doesn't work. But the two Meet the Parents that they did are very good. And Jay's I think a really talented director. I think he just has different interests. I think he didn't want to keep directing comedy, so he moved into the other things. And you are right, I think, a little bit that like Adam McKay is maybe sort of the better version of that, or sort of gets into it with a little bit more youthful.
I mean, it's part luck, right? Like, yeah. I do think that was a really smart connection between the two, because you're right. They both come out with these like sort of grand slam comedic sort of like powerhouses, and then do a transition. I'm just saying that one of them transitioned into something that won a couple Oscars, and the other did Bombshell. So like, you know, I think that they are super comparable, but I do think that one of them is a sort of more successful version of the other.
No, that's a fair point. Hey, but you know, Bombshell had two Oscar nominations, so you must remember that.
Ooh, so sorry. Did not know.
I think it did.
Sounds right. No, sure. I'm sure like Nicole Kidman or something was like nominated. Yeah.
Probably.
So after the unfreezing, some of the funniest stuff, I think, where he says, like, what finally, like, showed those capitalist pigs, comrades. Like, Austin, we won. Oh, yay, capitalism. It's great. And then Elizabeth Hurley's entrance, and it's something like, my God, Vanessa's got an amazing body. I bet she shags like a minx. Why do I feel as though the unfreezing process has halted my internal monologue? I didn't say that out loud, did I?
You skipped over another
the volume of my voice
joke. God, so good. Yeah. No, dude, the jokes per minute on this movie is high. It's very good. But I was saying another joke that is a not better but a more comedic version of an older joke is the decades long urination, which is just an over the top version, a Monty Python version of baseball, A League of Their Own, which came out about 5 years before this, what? You've never seen A League of Their Own?
No.
How?
No one showed it to me. I didn't seek it out.
To watch that at some point. It's a very fun movie.
Very good.
I'll watch it at some point.
It's Tom Hanks. Like, Americana.
Yeah. Rosie O'Donnell, baseball. Gina Davis.
It's Rosie O'Donnell and Madonna being good. Like, Madonna's legitimately very good in that movie. That movie's quite good, and you should see it. And it has a very famous urination scene, is what I'll say.
I feel like one thing in Austin Powers they probably wouldn't do today is Will Ferrell in brownface as Mustafa. Even though he's fucking hilarious,
it doesn't land a great joke though.
The eyebrows alone.
My calculations for the unfreezing process. I'm sorry, that did not account for what. Oh, he says like did not account for feline complications. Just that you shot me. Why would you shoot me?
Another bit that I think is done better in the second movie.
Oh no!
Oh man, I don't know about that.
He's down the hill and he breaks his leg and he's like, I will try to stand, and he tries to stand and he breaks his other leg. It's perfect. It is a crystallization. But no, the amount of people in this that are, because it's so this movie is obviously and Mike Myers has said it. It's like 40% improv. It's a very large amount improv for a movie that came out post. When that was sort of like, you know, a thing that a lot of movies were doing because film costs a lot of money.
You mean but before, not post, like
the I kind of mean both. Like they're not a lot of most of the comedies in the 90s are heavily scripted.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. Is you mean this came out before like Apatow and everyone were doing
tons. Sure, but no, I also meant after, because it also this comes out after Spinal Tap. This comes out after Holy Grail. This comes out after a lot of other movies that like are 100% improv.
Yeah.
But the you want to know the craziest thing, and I'll drop it just right in the middle here. The thing that I think is insane to me is that this movie has one writing credit, and it's Mike Myers.
Yeah,
that's it. That to me is a massive sign as to why such a crazy idea. That's just like a man who's like, I'm gonna parody an entire time period, and then loosely a character, but also it's a time travel. Is that he was able to do it just him. I'm sure that there's ghostwriters and help in this, that, or the other, but like the fact that if a comedy like this came out today, there's four names on it. Easy.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. That scene with, speaking of improv, where they, the villains are back in the 90s. I love how scared Patty O'Brien looks when they just say, this is Patty O'Brien. And he looks at everyone frightened as he's being introduced. And then, Mindy Sterling just improvised that whole thing about the Lucky Charms commercial. That's great.
Mindy Sterling, the amount. So Rhea Perlman was supposed to do this. And I am so glad that she, like, she turned it down, and she has said publicly that she regrets it, obviously, because it would have been a great part, and she would have been great. But man, no one else could be Frau Farbissina is perfect in every possible way. She just gets better. I think she's better in they use her better in every movie going forward, but she is so perfect in this. In every small bit. Later on, when he's going to kill Scotty, and she hits him with the writing crop. Unreal. She's a freaking genius. I've seen her at Groundlings. She's freakishly talented. Freakishly she's talented.
Great. No, that's a great moment. Or he's like talking about how they got kicked out of some store, and then he's like, oh, I don't know, I'll relax, get high, watch a titty movie, and this is how you plan to live your life. And that to kill him is great. Mr. Bigglesworth, the cat's real name is Ted Nude Gent.
Sweet. Really? I'm very into that. should have kept his real name.
Cat Scratch Fever.
Yeah. Jay Roach said that he thought of Dr. Evil as a guy who was like really happy in the 50s when world domination and being a square were cool. And so he especially hates Austin Powers, who represents all the, you know, free love and liberation of the 60s.
It is fun when you think about the fact that he has a bunch of dialogue sort of poking very accurately at the problems that Austin has coming to the future. But you're right that he is also of a further bygone era. Like he is from a very, very beginning of Bond, where like all he wants to do is his dumb evil scheme.
Yeah.
And like they're just aggressively stupid.
I mean, that's a good joke in the second one, is like, no, we can just have Starbucks now. And like that's today, like that works.
Well, it plays, coming back to the James Bond thing, right? I think that a thing that they do super, super smart and great is that every James Bond villain is a titan of industry. Every James Bond villain, as we've said, in the James Bond universe, you apparently reach a level of wealth where the next logical step is personal army. Yeah. Like every single one of them, whether or not they end up going quote unquote straight up evil, the level of personal security that they have is militia. Which is hysterical, and this movie I think hits it on the head so well, which is to say that like the regular wing of the business will always be more successful than the quote evil wing of the business.
Oh, and it's so great when What's the line? It's something like he's introducing the villains, and he's like, Frau Farbissina founded the militant wing of the Salvation Army. That's so fucking funny. Maybe the best line to just start a scene ever. Remember when we froze your semen? I love the introducing Scott, and then they do it like two or three times in the movie. It's just like a copyright free, like smells like Teen Spirit. When he's like storming out of his room, that I love.
I think one of the coolest things about this movie for me, as opposed to other parody movies, is I'm not going to say it looks like most parody movies are really made on the cheap. They're just like, I think about like the best of them, like Naked Gun, like Airplane.
Don't say anything about Top Secret now.
I've never seen it, so I've fallen asleep during it every time we watch it, so there's no way I could say anything about that movie. But even going back to like Monty Python or something, they all do a great job of what they, but they all look kind of cheap. They're all in like just a few, like a couple of sets or whatever. Yeah. They maybe save one big set for here or there or something, but they're always made cheap because like parodies are cheap. That's kind of their cheap comedies that you make, and they make people laugh. This movie, the sets necessarily aren't good, but it does feel big. They feel like I think it's just because it's a Bond movie, and they're trying to make you feel like you're globetrotting the way you would in a Bond movie. You go to
a lot
of
different
places. Well,
they do it so smart. Yeah.
Yeah, they do it very... Yeah, exactly. They do it very well. They do it knowing it's a comedy really well, too. Like, all the sets that are even supposed to be in exotic places are, like, kind of funny. They're kind of, like...
Yeah, they're, like, a little bad.
Yeah.
There's two perfect things for exactly that. It's when they're in the shark pit with the purposely fake bad rocks, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's so cheap in the right way, because that was... That's exactly what they're clearly making fun of, is those parts of Bond movies where you're like, so this is where you needed to save.
Yeah.
So Mr. Broccoli, this is where you're the, you know, the dollar hit the dime. And the other perfect one is the secret UN room which is just a black space, just an empty black space with a super cool, like James Bondian TV screen and literally nothing else. Yeah. It's just black emptiness behind them.
And they have like a sumo wrestler is like representing Japan. Yeah. Like that's great also, where Jay Roach was saying like he wanted to parody how in the movies, I think specifically again, like You Only Live Twice has the opening where it's like the super Russian guy and the super American guy are talking in the like UN or whatever meeting it is, and he was like, you know, being Canadian, I wanted to make sure we had one Mountie in there to represent Canada.
Yeah.
It does look cheap in the right ways at times. It still looks like it cost a lot, considering, like, I was just amazed to learn that less than $20 million for the 90s even. Like, that's impressive.
Yeah, even the places that are not just sets aside, like, the costumes, all they're ridiculous. They look good, though. They don't look, like, cheap or anything. It's really well made, and it's made very smartly for a parody movie. They kind of make you forget it's a parody movie and, like, its visual style.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting. I think that might set it apart a little bit from some of the other really classic movies of that genre.
So what it does for me, and this is, I'll get into this a little bit, because it's like, obviously I could spend an hour and a half just essentially re-quoting the movie, which is hilarious. This movie is exactly an hour. It's an hour 29.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a tight hour 29. It is packed.
And that's also like, there are movies like this that are made today that are maybe have almost as many laughs, but then they're 2 hours long, so they drag and they just don't work as well.
Yeah.
But this movie does something that I think the best of the best parodies do, which is that it took its source and it understood the tone that it has to be. Which is something I think that is easier for actors than it is necessarily for directors and editors and stuff like that. But as a group, everyone knew the tone so well. And then they said, let's now tell a good story while doing it. Because the best parodies still have to be good movies. And which is, to me, why movies like Scream, or sorry, not Scream, scary movie or any of that genre or ilk, I don't really like, and I don't think that they will hold through the test of time, because they're exceptional parodies of their very specific thing, but there's nothing behind it.
Yeah.
There's nothing behind the joke. When the fembots come out, you understand that this is supposed to be a Bond spoof, but the mythos of Austin Powers has already been so well established that it is an Austin Powers joke, not a James Bond joke.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that the best parodies, you know, Mel Brooks as well, it's like, oh, well, these are also just characters at this point.
They're also just good versions of they're also just good versions of the thing they are parodying, right?
Yeah.
The perfect examples to me are Spinal Tap, Galaxy Quest, and Austin Powers. They are films that fit their own genre and are also spoofs of their genre.
And I don't know, I'm just a sap also, but it's like, it's a ridiculous, but, you know, brilliant and hilarious parody, but like a movie like Spinal Tap, you actually care when Nigel Tufnel gets on the stage at the end, where it's like, oh, wow. Like, they'll have, these movies will still have those moments where it's like, oh, fuck, I actually care about this character? Like, am I stupid, or is this movie, like, brilliant?
You care about his failure with the, when he has the druid set. You care about you care about how much he cares when he says in ancient times.
Like, I care a lot the whole movie.
Like, well, that's what makes those movies so good, is that everyone takes it with a level of seriousness, a level of reverie that allows it to be real art.
And Austin Powers too, I've been struck watching it as an adult. They take just the tiniest care so that you actually care a little bit about the characters and the romance, where, like, Austin's actually kind of a good guy, as much as he's playfully asking for sex for most of the movie. When Elizabeth Hurley's trying to have sex with him, he won't because she's too drunk. They also, for the, like, a couple of the romantic scenes between him and her, they give him a better set of teeth that aren't quite as gross. So, like, you're subconsciously going to be like, oh, he's not the most hideous man ever. Yeah.
His teeth purposely get better after they make the joke about where she gives him toothpaste. Not kidding. Every scene after that, his teeth are a better set of teeth, which is super funny. Great. But that is an excellent point, is that they allow. So this, I thought, was something really interesting that is, let me put it this way. The true success of this film is how well it comes off with how poorly Elizabeth Hurley acts in this movie. She is very good in this because she's the perfect look and type for a Bond girl. Does she just chew up some scenery sometimes. Man, when she's doing the bit in the hotel room, are her eyes very clearly on the camera so that she can do everything correctly. That aside,
That seems like a technical exercise, though, and I don't think it's a great joke in the first place, where I don't fault her for that bit.
I kind of do, though, still, because I still think that a better actor would have done better with it. Because you side-eye the camera. You don't just stare down the lens of whatever it is that's letting her do the thing. It's not that hard of a thing to, because she has a partner in the joke who is also has a timing that he can adjust to her.
I think they thought that because there were two monitors that her going back and forth wouldn't be evident.
It's so bad. It's super evident.
Still, I'm not sure in 97, I don't know anyone was more attractive than Elizabeth Hurley, so we'll give her that.
No, she's absolutely perfect for it.
Did you recognize Larry Thomas, the soup Nazi, as
the black or whatever?
Yeah, the blackjack dealer.
Blackjack dealer, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love, for some reason, a quote that sticks out, even though it's not funny, is him saying, "It's 17, sir." Yeah, so and then in the exact same quality, being like, "It's 5, sir." Yeah.
That's a great joke.
I suggest you hit.
not hitting on five. I also like to live dangerously.
So that's such a good joke. Yeah.
It is also, it is so smart. It is such, it's so smart in a dumb way to be like, this man is James Bond in so many ways, but he's also super not. He's atrocious at games and he doesn't care.
I think that might be one of the funnier scenes in the movie. The whole casino sequence. And then after with going to the bathroom.
Oh, astounding. Astounding. Give it hell.
Give it up. Yeah, Tom Arnold is the Texan guy.
Tom Arnold is so good in that little
dumb scene.
He's
so good.
I think, improv'd a lot of that. Like, hey, sounds pretty rough, buddy. How about a courtesy flush?
How about a courtesy flush?
That is so good.
Oh, a courtesy flush has lived in my existence for the last 23 years.
I hadn't heard that phrase before this movie. The card table too, though, where he can't say vagina, and he's like, Miss. First he's like, I'm sorry, it sounded like you said your name was. Anyway, and then he's like, Miss. China.
Yeah, I was gonna say a more important F has not existed in history. The two of them, when she and number two say vagina, they hit the F perfectly. It's not what you think it is. It's a lot of vagina. She's clearly just an Italian woman.
And that scene also has allow myself to introduce myself. Oh yeah!
Oh no! But
that scene was playing. I was watching it in my living room last night, and Alotta set off the Alexa in that room, and so it was like a lot of vagina, and then have like, I'm sorry, I don't know what that is.
It's like neither did we when we watched it at 9.
Yeah.
Thank you.
At 9. Yeah.
Thank you. But no, it's. That scene also, the a lot of vagina scene is also all the callback to every time that James Bond has ever been around a Japanese or Chinese person, which is amazing that they did that with an Italian person. Like, they call back the whole sponge bath scene from whatchamacallit.
You Only Live Twice.
Yeah.
But then she also, like, quotes You Only Live Twice and said in Japan, men come first, women come second.
Yeah,
it's like what
for his brilliant or and sometimes not at all.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah, also his like just his like he has a little like limerick about how he farted.
It's the fart jokes in that scene are the weirdest. They're so not necessary. They work. It works
pretty well.
But like I have to think that that came from them talking. It came from reality?
Well, what the story is that they had set it up where Basil Exposition was going to say something at the beginning after the unfreezing process about how because of the unfreezing process, in moments of relaxation, like, may cause flatulence, or it's going to be some weird setup to that, and then he farts. It's like, paid off in that, and Mike Myers is like, it's fine, it's just a fart joke. It works. Like,
yeah, it weirdly endears, not only does it endear you to him, it is such a smart way to just be like, obviously James Bond farts. But we don't. It's the 24 conundrum, right? Where like you have a TV show of 24, and then after enough seasons came out, the joke is when the hell does he pee? And like you get that in a funny way with a lot of the Austin Powers stuff, where you're like, yeah, James Bond definitely loses at cards sometimes because cards is random gambling, and he definitely farts, and he definitely sometimes doesn't get the girl. But, like, we don't ever get to see that. And, like, Austin Powers doesn't care if you see that.
There's a British TV sketch comedy called Laughin' that aired from 67 to 73 that I guess did a similar thing. Mike Myers said it inspired the psychedelic transitions where he's, like, dancing with all the, like, flower people.
Yeah.
Amazing. That to me, is like, that tone that they create is just so magical, and like it allows for so much forgiveness to be able to transition from scene to scene in that very TV way, but just like they establish it early enough that like it allows your brain to just be okay with kind of messy time jumps that are needed for a movie like this.
It does kind of tell you, like, we're doing sketch comedy also. Like, it feels like SNL or The Groundlings or something, where it's, okay, now it's, we're going to have this bit. I would go in for a sec to the like, group therapy with Carrie Fisher, which is a great scene. Like, I wrote down, I would watch a feature film that was just Dr. Evil monologue about his past. That one of the funniest monologues in movies.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
My father would make outrageous claims such as that he invented the question mark. Yeah. My mother was a 15-year-old whore with webbed feet. I was working in England a couple years ago. A few of my coworkers one day were kept saying, like, orange sherbet, orange sherbet. And I was like, what's that from? And they were like, Austin Powers. And I was like, what scene of Austin Powers? And he's like, remember, like, Christian Slater says that. And I was like, Christian Slater's not in Austin Powers. And they were like, yeah, he is. I looked it up. I found it on YouTube. There's a different, longer cut of the movie in England.
Only in England. I saw that.
Yeah. Did you watch that scene?
No, but I looked that up today when I was doing a little research. So I guess, yeah. That was only in the English theatrical release?
Did they mention why it was cut from here?
No, I just looked up that it was in there. I never saw anything beyond that.
Yeah, it's like at the end of the movie when they sneak into the... they're at the Virchicon or something and sneak off. And Christian Slater's like a security guard. Austin Powers like, don't worry, I'll take care of him. I learned how to hypnotize people from this guru in India, really setting up the love guru for a few years later for him.
Yeah.
And then he basically does the Jedi mind trick, or he's like, repeat after me, everything seems to be fine here. And Christian Slater like says that back, and then he's like, I'm going across the street now for some orange sherbet. And it's just Christian Slater is repeating this back with like cross-eyed and like a bad English accent, and I guess that was really funny to English people.
It was in there, apparently, as I did not know until today. So that's my second favorite cameo of the movie, after just Michael McDonald being henchman Steve with the...
Brilliant.
I've never seen that cameo. Just great.
Wait, who's that?
With the stop.
Oh.
So yeah, just another beautiful like piece of improv, and just another improver who jumps in, like, obviously famous to all of us nowadays and whatnot from Mad TV and a whole bunch of different like small film projects and stuff. But that scene is the perfect example of the other reason why I think this movie is so smart, and the thing that it does, especially in an hour 29, as we said, that is so intelligent that a lot of comedies now have started to lose, which is that it is not afraid to take time. Mm-hmm. That joke develops over such a long period of time. That joke does it. The same happens with the with the truck in the hallway.
Yeah.
That joke takes a million years. The pee joke, all those jokes that it trusts that the audience is going to get it, and it trusts that the audience is going to like it. All of those longer jokes, I think, are so smart, and they don't happen enough in modern film.
I think my favorite of those is the Swedish penis enlarger. And it's like, I think he's going back to like Monty Python there with the, like, it's daring you to get bored and to check out, because you're taking something that is funny, you're doing it so long that it stops being funny, and then you're bringing it back around again to being hilarious.
Yes.
Where it's like, exactly. You're over it by the time he's like, no, that sort of thing ain't my bag, baby. And then he's like, one book, The Swedish Penis Enlarger and Me, this sort of thing is my bag, baby, by Austin Danger Powers.
I kind of wish that they didn't, because they bring the pump back two more times. I wish they didn't. I wish that they let that die there. Because of that exact reason, it's that older style of comedy that just it exactly as you said, it's like, I think this is funny, and therefore you have to.
Yeah,
because you paid for the ticket. Yeah. You're here too, buddy.
It's the same thing happens with Holy Hand Grenade, where I come back when he's like, yes! Five is right out.
Right out. Oh no, man! Ugh, I love Monty Python, and yeah, that is one of those moments. There are a lot of those moments in this that are great, because that's obvious. That's the same as with like I'm Very Badly Burnt. It's the same thing. It's daring you to get bored in that moment, or it's daring you to think that he's actually dead. And you have the phone call. You have Dr. Evil trying to continue the meeting.
Yeah,
and you just it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, there's also deleted scenes with there's one with Lois Childs, who is of course Holly Goodhead in Moonraker, playing the wife of the guy who gets run over.
I've seen that scene.
Yeah, and then same exact idea. Rob Lowe plays a guy who's at Hooters. I think it's a bachelor party at Hooters, and the guy about to be married is the guy whose head got eaten by the sea bass. they're both pretty funny, and yeah, you can also get why they were cut for time, but yeah.
That is another great one of those jokes is after the guy gets his head chopped off is that very Bondian thing where he's making jokes, but he is so in a way that you could imagine Sean Connery. He likes them so much that he says a bunch of them.
Yeah, I like how she's like doesn't really laugh, but she just like
she just smiles.
She just patiently tolerates the first three, and then four comes and she's like, okay, let's go.
Yeah.
Well, it's also too like that the Michael McDonald with the just obviously a guy who doesn't have to die choosing is also funny in a Bond spoof, because there's so many Bond movies where you watch like the old ones where like the death logic appeal is like, well, wow, they could have absolutely gotten out of this. So it functions on a couple. It's like a funny joke in and of itself.
Yeah.
But it's also really funny as a parody of like a lot of Bond deaths where you're like, that person absolutely should not have died. And I find it to be like a really clever joke on multiple levels.
When you get to that point, when they get into the evil lair is when you get into into their most, truly Bond specific spoofing in the best way, you have he dresses them up in the silver outfits and he calls it out. He's like, I've dressed you in these semi futuristic costumes, and then he does the thing that all of us know now is one of the most quoted things when we were kids, which is the all I wanted was frickin' sharks with frickin' lasers on their heads.
I think one of the best like very specific and completely dead on accurate parodies in this movie that I remember even as a kid just dying laughing at home, like watching it with my dad, is Dr. Evil, like Scott being like, what are you doing? I've got a gun in my room. Fucking shoot them. And he's like, son, you just don't get it. It's my job to place them in an easily escapable situation involving a very slow and overly elaborate death and just leave them alone and hope that everything goes to plan. Yeah. Like, that's brilliant.
And that really ruined Bond movies forever after that. You can never do that again now.
The scene starts even more simply and perfectly. Because Scott comes in and sees that they have been served food, and he literally the first thing he says is, "Why are you feeding them?"
Yeah,
which is an excellent question.
Yeah, but it's the whole Bond and his villains are gonna just be gentlemen the whole time, and so it is great where they sit down at the table and he just introduces him like it's his cousin or something, where he's like, "Oh, Scott, this is my arch nemesis, Austin Powers."
So good. You want to come watch Daddy at work? So just
blow me. What did you say? Show me.
Yeah. Oh okay. Man. All of their scenes together are the two of them, and like have just such good energy with one another.
Yeah.
It's in the second movie that it's one of my favorite lines from the second movie, just when he's naming his plan Dr. Evil, and he's named it Preparation H. And Scotty, you can just hear he laughs in the background. He's just like, it's. Preparation Ages of Medicine, your whole plan is called Operation Ass Cream, you ass. Just something that as a kid I would say constantly.
Man, Spy Who Shagged Me really is a good movie. You've really turned me, Max.
I'm sorry. I really love both of them. I think the third one's like is where it starts to dip. because they start to play them out. But I really do think that a lot of the jokes, because you get a lot of the great Moonraker stuff in Spyro Shack.
Yeah.
Which is all really strong.
Okay, so that's a question that I don't quite have an answer for, but if you had to say one classic Bond movie that is the most evident in this movie.
I would say You Only Live Twice, I feel like, is the most...
Yeah.
All the Connerys in general, I feel like, are very, very parodied.
It's mostly the Connery movies.
Yeah.
Spy
and Shagney has a little bit more of a more flavor to it.
100%.
We've got the ruffled tuxedo shirt from Honor Majesty's, but I might go with diamonds in a way. We've got the Vegas setting,
a little bit of diamonds in there.
It's the most outlandish.
Scenes, yeah.
The costumes with the henchmen with the hard hats and stuff. Yeah, a lot of that in this one.
This is not a thing that there's a bunch of, but one of the jokes that I forgot about, and I'm not kidding, I turned away from my screen and was laughing so hard that I doubled over a little, is that towards the end of this, when they're going to send the drill into the earth, and Dr. Evil is in the Dr. No plastic suit, and he keeps lifting his...
Yeah.
I can't... Oh, you got this, Max. You got this. He keeps lifting his arms up, and the suit just comes up with him. That is the dumbest, most perfect joke. And it's not mentioned, and it's just a shot of it happening, and like number two or a henchman or whoever is watching it happen is just sort of like, what do you do? No one else is in a suit like that. It's so very clearly just like, we're doing Dr. No. But what we're doing is we're showing you how ridiculous this would be.
Yeah.
I nearly had to pause the movie. I was like, I was on the ground. It was so funny.
I think both You Only Live Twice and Diamonds Are Forever have the vaguely kind of Russian sounding like countdown guy in the labs at the end. They were like 30 seconds till self-destruct or till impact. So that's like, they're barely changing that for this. You want to do our, did you make a list of your favorite parody movies? That the,
I did.
Your personal,
I could easily.
Mount Rushmore.
It's tough. Yeah. There's a lot of ones that I like kind of similarly.
So yeah, I didn't mine even mine won't be like a one through whatever. Mine is just a smorgasbord.
See, yeah, I didn't. It's hard to, how do you define it? I think where I ended up was like, if this thing, you know, I'm sure there's kids who watched Austin Powers didn't really know about James Bond, but in general, as a pop culture property, like, can this thing exist without this other thing, or does it sort of? Is part of the concept relying on you knowing about stuff like Austin Powers or disaster movies or whatever?
Well, no, but I think, yeah, all the best parody movies are good because they don't necessarily end up relying on the thing that they're... Max, your point earlier about, like, Scary Movie, where it doesn't really have, like... There's nothing else going on other than riffing on other horror movies. There's no, like... All the best parodies kind of have more going on to them that makes them classic, and it becomes really, really hard because there's guys that do it really well too. Like, how could you pick a favorite Mel Brooks one? How could you pick a favorite Zucker Brothers one? Monty Python one?
Max, when you said Holy Grail a few minutes ago, and I was like, fucking course, that's one of my favorites. That's a parody movie. I didn't put that on my list because I wasn't even... Well, I think we were talking about, it's Monty Python and the Holy Grail is so good that I just think of it as like, it's a King Arthur movie. Like,
yeah, that's the other thing. Is like, what is actually a parody? Because that's not a parody of any one movie necessarily per se. It's sort of a parody of just King Arthur in general.
No,
like
I think you can do that, where it's like, if it's just a parody of like science fiction.
Yeah, I was going to say, like a parody of a genre.
It doesn't have to be a parody.
I do agree with you, because I looked at a couple of lists, because that's who I am and that's what I do, is when I'm asked for stuff like this, I obviously want to see what other people said. And there were certain things where I was like, I think that there is a very... person to person, I don't think it's defined, I think there's a person-to-person differential, and it's a gray area between what is a parody and what is like and what is just sort of broad satire, right?
Yeah.
Like for example, on a bunch of parody lists, it was saying two movies that are two of my not just favorite comedies or favorite this are two of my favorite movies of all time, being Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz.
Oh, but yeah.
I would call them satires, not yeah. parodies, because they are not. Yeah. But that's the problem, right? Is that Holy Grail kind of is also a satire, but it weirdly, because of the prevalence of the Arthurian myth specifically, it then also is a bit of a parody. It does both.
So I would just say that I would rope Holy Grail more into satire than
yeah,
than
I'm parody, fine with that
personally.
Yeah, I'm. However you want to define this for your own list is fine, because already, like, I'm furious at myself for not having Monty Python or Spinal Tap. I think because of what I said about Monty Python and, like, I don't know, that I just didn't do, like, the documentary kind of
I would throw
thing.
Spinal Tap, for me, too, a little bit in this more satire. It's not necessarily... it just depends on what you're defining parody yeah. as. And also parody is a film genre as. I don't really know. It's yeah. a very broad thing, so.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I think that there's gray area between the two. I think that yeah. I think that those, it's not, it is a, it's the film definition of a I know it when I see it, right? I think that person to yeah. person, they're both under the same umbrella, but like separate, but like it is very, it's a gray area.
Well, so I came up with my list in a minute or two and was like, I'm not going to overthink it. I'm going to write down these ones and hopefully, because those are the first that came to mind. So I'll say that my number four parody or spoof movie pick, I have Woody Allen's Sleeper, which we mentioned a little bit ago. I think it's hilarious. And I think it's a little gray area, but I think that movie doesn't get made and doesn't quite work without stuff like 2001, Logan's Run, even Planet of the Apes. I think it's a lot of the sci-fi that's come out in the last decade or two before that. And it obviously just a throwback to kind of Marx Brothers and silent comedies and all the stuff that Woody Allen loves. Really funny movie. What are your guys' number fours? If you had to rank them.
I didn't really rank them in any order, so I'd say you rank all yours.
Oh, well,
then...
just what name a movie, then.
Oh, well, then I name... I'll say this is my number four only, because I know it's not a great movie by any means, but is a parody, and as a kid, one of my favorite movies, Spaceballs. Gotta throw it in there.
Hell yeah.
It's...
Yeah, it's on my... Yeah. It's in my general list.
Yeah. Not the best Mel Brooks movie, not even pretending it is.
It's the closest to a parody, though.
Yeah, 12-year-old Will was real into Spaceballs, yeah. So.
But it and Men in Tights, which I also as a kid loved, not yeah. his best work, arguably towards the bottom of his works. But yeah. But the two of those are are helped by what we just all suffered through for a minute, which is that I think that his best ones that are parodies, i.e. Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles, are also more broadly satire than parody. In a very similar way. But, like, Spaceballs is Star Wars. That's it. That's it. It's one thing. And it does it so good. There's Pizza the Hut. I don't know what else you want. There's a man named Pizza the Hut. And then another man eats a pepperoni off of him and says, delicious. Like, it's brilliant. It is a parody in such a clean way that Mel Brooks called George Lucas to see if it was okay. He asked
right.
him. He asked him if it was okay, and he said, everything is fine, it's totally okay, as long as Lone Star isn't in a Han Solo outfit. And so he's not. The yeah. costume designer designed him an Indiana Jones costume, which the next time you watch that movie, he's just Indiana Jones. It's great. It's brilliant.
I think George Lucas also said that they couldn't, he gave him permission if they didn't do toys, because he didn't want yeah. like the knockoff, like, laser sword shit yeah. where he didn't want kids to confuse Star Wars toys with Spaceballs toys.
Which is why it turns into the best joke in the movie.
But then Lucas gave him, like, all the, they got to use all the ILM effect stuff, like that same same production company, everything. Effects House did Spaceballs, and special effects are good.
I quote that movie constantly. I'm totally. I don't. You like sold it as if you had to apologize. That movie's fucking hysterical.
No, I think it's held up over time a lot better maybe than I thought it initially was as a kid, which is like a really dumb movie.
He's a Mog. He's half man, half dog. just my luck, a Druish princess. That movie's perfect. That movie's amazing.
You know, Max, as you said, like, well, I tried to watch Men in Tights a couple of years ago and maybe made it halfway in and was like, nah, yeah. I'm good. but it, Spaceballs is, yeah, still funny.
Men in Tights is a movie that has about four good scenes and then a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. Max, what's one of your picks?
I'll go ahead. As I said, these are not in order. All the movies that you guys are going to list are, I also hold up there because I did the same thing. I'm not overthinking it. Which is why my quote unquote number four it might piss you off in a very similar way to my adorance of Spy Who Shagged Me. I'm gonna say Hot Shots Part Deux.
I'm fine with that. I'm not gonna hold that against
you. I prefer it. I think it's better than Hot Shots.
I was watching part of that the other day. Yeah, fucking hilarious. It's great.
Hot Shots Part Deux is wicked funny. Or I'm going to put it in a tie because this is not truly a parody, but I'm going to put it into a tie with the parody scenes from UHF.
Uh-huh.
Because UHF, not a parody, but there are parts of it that are parody and they're brilliant.
One of the best
parody in UHF is astoundingly funny.
I think Hot Shots Derv, one of the best like comedy trailers ever, just doing the whole... if you remember it, it's doing the whole Rambo thing of he's like gearing up, muscular and everything, the bandana and the gun, and it's like Sheen, and then a little parentheses Charlie, and then like he walks so forward, hits his head, is shooting the gun everywhere.
It's so good,
it's great.
There's the brilliant scene, the thing. So this happens early in the movie. It's the thing that sells it for me. Is that in that. The early sex scene with the girl before he like has to quote go back and everything is that they set it up like she's gonna kill him and she reaches under the pillow and pulls out a screwdriver to fix the squeaky bed, which is great because they play a trope onto itself. They're like, the squeaky bed is supposed to be like, oh, we don't actually have to show you sex to say that it's sex. And then it's like, no, the bed is actually just squeaky. They were totally having sex, but also we need to fix the squeaky bed. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant joke.
Again, same with Scary Movie. I definitely saw that and that scene before Basic Instinct. So it was like years later, it was like, oh, wait, I get what this was about.
Yeah. I love Hot Shots Part 2. Not great, but on my list.
I have as my number three pick, Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. I feel like we've...
that would be my number three,
we've
too.
We've covered that, yeah.
Mine is also Austin Powers, comma, all of them, is my sort of general like thing.
Then my number two, I feel like it's impossible to go without it, but I'm not doing it just to do it. I do think it's one of the funniest movies ever, Airplane.
That's my number two as well.
Oh, high five.
Airplane is so easy to say that it's not on my list because I think it is so.
No, and I can.
It's funny. The thing that came down to for me kind of ranking it there is. Whether or not most people know that it is a true parody from the standpoint of parodying
it's the airport
movie. So
it's parodying like almost directly scene for scene. It parodies,
Airport
the name of it.
77 or 75.
Like, there's a couple of airport movies, so like
a few airport
zero hour exclamation point.
Yeah.
Is a movie that they're directly almost scene for scene doing.
I love it, and not that it's a prerequisite, but that is a true parody, and it's literally just making fun of one movie, which is why I put it on.
But it's also, it's making fun of so many, it's making fun of, like, commercials from the time, and it's making fun of anything that they can make fun of, and I feel like you can't do a parody list without the suckers. They're some of the best at parodying specific things, but also just, like, being really brilliant about, like, a single shot could have three different jokes going on.
Yep.
And there's stuff in the background, and you can, I'll watch Airplane today for like the 20th time, and it's like, oh, I never noticed that joke. I never noticed this thing. It's just so, I think Ebert said when like Siskel and Ebert doing maybe like Naked Gun 2 or something, were like, look, this isn't like, he might have said it about Airplane, where he's like, not every joke works, but there's so many jokes that you just, it's more laughs than like three regular comedies or something. Yeah. Like, it's just so jam packed with funny shit.
Yeah.
My number two, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Again, not in an order, because this might be my number one in a perfect world. It is This Is Spinal Tap. It is, yeah. in a similar way to Airplane, but just a little bit enough different. Where Airplane I didn't put, because it essentially perfects and creates the concept of a direct parody, like a true parody. Spinal Tap created what is now essentially the only genre of parody that comes out, the mockumentary.
Yeah.
It is the first mockumentary, and as we've already talked about, so we don't have to, it does it to such a level that you love it. It becomes a part of the genre of rock stories that it's trying to make fun of. It's just an unreal, perfect movie that is so good that it has like jokes in it that people, in a similar way that Airplane does, Don't Call Me Shirley. There are people that have never seen Airplane that know that joke. And very, very similarly, this one goes to 11. Like, yeah, there are jokes that are so big that you don't have to know what it's from to know it.
It's so good, and it's so accurate that at times you're just like, well, how, it's just real. Like, how different is this from The Last Waltz or Gimme Shelter or like an actual like rock movie? It's not on my list. That's kind of a mistake. It's
how black is it?
Again, it's none, only yeah.
It's
only
none. Cause... It's none more black.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm just as God made me, sir.
I forgot. Oh, that movie's perfect. Oh man, that's a movie so good that Billy Crystal plays that Billy Crystal and Fran Drescher are in it, and you don't even think about it. You don't even know it because everyone else is so good. And also I have to grandfather it in, because even though they're not truly parodies, they are satire. It is the first time that the world truly gets to see what Christopher Guest can do. And then he went on and did every one of his movies.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. And you're right. Those aren't necessarily parodies or satires. I mean, they're more just mockumentaries in general, but they are all very, very good.
Yeah.
Waiting for Guffman is an absolute classic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you said Billy Crystal and Fran Drescher are in it for a second. So is Bruno Kirby. Dana Carvey doesn't even speak in it. He's just the other mime there.
He's the other mime, yeah.
You know, it isn't a joke. I mean, she should be made to smell the glove. That's the last thing I'll say.
Oh God! What's wrong with being sexist?
Yeah, sexy.
What's wrong with being sexy? No, sexist.
Max, you've already argued that my number one pick should not be classified as a parody. I will argue that it still is. It's gray area, but I have Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. I'm totally, as I said, I think that it is a person-to-person thing. I would never say that it isn't, like, because there's, I don't think that there's a definitive thing. That's also one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, much like Spaceballs getting to use the ILM effects. I mean, they got to shoot in the same sets, use the same castle and props and everything as the James Whale Frankenstein movies. We talked about, like, it's a hilarious movie that just ends up having its own character logic and motivations, so they can just make jokes within that world that don't have to be referencing other things. But yeah,
he was my boyfriend.
Yeah, sedative. Yeah, it's one of the funniest movies ever.
That movie's perfect, and it lives in that same Spinal Tap era airplane world where like Abby someone is a thing that you don't have to have seen the movie to have probably heard a human being say, or like the entire reason why Putting on the Ritz is still sort of a song we all know and care about.
Oh, the Abby scene where he's like, Igor, sit down. Like, tell me, did you get this person's brain? No? No, okay.
It was, whose brain Abby
did
something.
You get? Yeah.
Abby, no.
You guys, your number ones? Or?
Well, I just like to say, having brought up Young Frankenstein, I definitely, this was a fun list to sort of rank because instead of trying to think of what I thought was the best movie, I really just tried to think the most about what, again, like I based out two criteria. What was the like purest parody? There's a making fun of one movie, and which one probably makes me laugh the most. And number one for me that hits both, I think, really well is Naked Gun.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. I think the original Naked Gun is one of the funnier movies ever made.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a little bit like, for me, Airplane on steroids. Like, it's even funnier second to second sometimes. And again, even just thinking about what makes me laugh the most, even going back to being like a child, that one is unmatched. And I think, you know, Blazing Saddles is probably a better parody or satire. I think Young Frankenstein probably is too, but for the sheer laugh factor, which is that what's these are all about, gotta go Naked Gun number one, and would stand by it.
For some reason I was just thinking about the other day the whole like when he's first sees Priscilla Presley, and he's like, oh yeah, she's a perfect woman, like curvy, like talking about how sexy she is, and he's like, yeah, she definitely reminded me of my mother, all right. And then they hit the joke again when, what's the guy's name?
George Kennedy.
George Kennedy comes in. He's like, Frank, snap out of it. You're looking at her like she was your mother.
So, yeah, that's number one for me.
The, mine. As I said, they weren't in any order, but I think that for fun, I might argue that this one, to me, is a cut above the rest in one very specific way. And I'm selling this early because because of the way that you guys have placed it, it is now quote unquote against Young Frankenstein and Naked Gun. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. I think that it is a perfect parody because it parodies two things at once, which I think is astounding. And it is Galaxy Quest, a film that I think is a perfect movie that both parodies the content of Star Trek in such a way that it becomes what in a lot of people have argued, a lot of like of Star Trek nerds, it becomes the best Star Trek movie, arguably. And at the same time, it parodies the real life human beings that those things are based on.
Yeah,
the real life actors. The that
I can't
those
disagree. I hadn't even thought about it in this context.
It,
so
it parodies on these two levels, and it constantly plays between them in this perfect miasma where the aliens and the fight and the things that they're doing, it handles it in a very modern parody way where it's like, how would we react to being forced into an old time Star Trek episode? And you react by being like, you lie to the bad guy, and then you're like, great, shoot off the missiles, left, right, do this, that, and the other. And then the whole time, Winona Ryder's in the background being like, you're still on with him. Sigourney Weaver is in the background. She's like, you're still on with him. And he goes, I gave you the cut signal. And she goes, no, you gave me the weird dead signal. Like, and then at the same time, you have all of the stuff you have all the Tim Allen beauty of the fact that he is also being Shatner and being the craziness that is conventions and that time period and like the way that fans can obsess over things. And it does the two of them in such a crazy, amazing way that like it is a perfect parody to me.
My parents used to quote the Gilligan's Island joke all the time, where they're like, you must have gotten like, yeah. Did you think Gilligan's Island was historical documents? Those poor people.
I quote Galaxy Quest on a weekly basis. Like, weekly. I quoted it yesterday. Yesterday, while I was talking to a friend, I was like, let's get out of here before they kill Guy. Like, Sam Rockwell, astounding in that movie.
And
playing the joke it perfectly of every Star Trek, where it's the red shirt joke, which is brilliant. And also playing the joke of, at the same time, playing the other joke of the person who's at conventions who was in like five episodes of a thing because it's a paycheck. Like, it's just, it plays on so many different levels. I love that movie. I think that movie is perfect.
Yeah, I would have watched a spinoff of Sam Rockwell and Tony Shalhoub.
That's so good.
Don't open that. How do we know the air is breathable? Just like...
Yeah. Why are you opening that? Is there air? You don't know. Is exactly what it says. And then it starts open and he takes a big old deep breath. It's genius. And then there's all the little kids are down there that are all mining. And it's like, oh, it's miners. And he goes, I said miners, not miners. That movie is genius. Again, nowhere near, comedically, nowhere near Naked Gun. And I think that overall film sort of importance, nowhere near Young Frankenstein. But like, it lives in this little corner in my heart the same way that the 99 Mummy does, as a movie that I think is a perfect representation of what it tried to do.
I think it's a great... I have no qualms about that being your number one. I didn't even think about it in this... It's a fantastic movie. And I would say I like that as much. I haven't seen it as much. I didn't see it until I was probably older. So it doesn't like resonate with me the way that Naked Gun or like Young Frankenstein does, because I've seen it so many times since being a young kid. Mm-hmm. But I definitely... I think I would say I like it just as much watching it.
I saw Galaxy Quest in a theater and
me too.
And rented it my parents.
Yeah, right. I mean, after. I don't think I saw it until I moved out here. I don't think I saw it until it was on like TV one day randomly. So
it's a formative memory. It's a formative memory for me because I remember I saw it in a theater, and when there's the alien that is obsessed with the Spock character. There's one of the guys that's obsessed, and he gets shot, and he I'm still laughing at it because I still think it's funny, but he like turns and it's as we said, it's heart wrenching. Like, you care about these people so much by the end of the movie, but he turns and he says, I'm shot, but he does it. And it's what it's meant to be. And it's really well acted. It's meant to be like the shock literally of like, I didn't think I could die, because it's this headstrong, like hardy, like overly religious character. But as a kid, as a 9-year-old in the theater, because it came out in 1999, I laughed his like big old belly laugh when he says, I'm shot. Dead silent theater. And my mom just turned to me. It was like, shush. Just as like, and I will forever remember that as this moment where I was like, oh, there are going to be things, Max, that you think are funny that aren't. There are going to be moments, because I laugh at everything, there are going to be things where you're going to have to shut up, because other people aren't ready to laugh about it yet.
Yeah, like the Lincoln assassination.
Exactly. How funny is it that John Wilkes Booth was in a play about like an assassination? It's hysterical.
Hilarious.
Well, I've got this miniature sack here filled with movies that I consider to be related in some way to James Bond. If you guys feel strongly against a pick, you can veto it.
Are you going to pull one live?
With both of your votes. We're going to pull one live.
You're going to pull one on air, quote unquote? Amazing.
On air. Mr. Schlick is doing the honors.
Go for it.
What do we got? Our next movie will be...
Oh, it's Legally What Blonde. Women Want with Mel Gibson? How's that related to James Bond?
Considered not, for James not, Bond in the 80s.
It's not What Men Want. It's not the
no, it's
weird.
Not the, yeah, it's not the ladies reboot. It's specifically What Women Want with Mel Gibson. Yeah. Which I have to say, is that just one you wanted to talk about?
Yeah.
Or we...
It's also weird that you wrote with Mel Gibson on it, Will. Like, that's, we all knew who was in it.
It's got a picture of his face, too.
Yeah, it also has a heart over the eye.
Yeah.
Super weird.
Oh, yeah, it's disturbing. Do you want to know what I actually got, though?
I would like to know what it actually is.
I think we'll like this. Mission Impossible.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Wow. The fact that we randomly pulled, like, I think the only other better pull would have been the first Bourne movie.
Yeah.
Well, see, what I did with the I just put for like Bourne, Mission Impossible, Austin Powers, I just put as many movies as there are the names of series in there. So we've got Mission Impossible, we got Austin Powers. Obviously, we'll start with the first one. So
that's great, and it's a great second push.
Yeah.
The one thing that bothers me is we're going from talking about a movie that doesn't have too much of a plot because it's a parody to a movie that has plot at all.
The most plot of all time.
Yeah, so
I don't know what you're talking about. It has all the plot that I need, and that plot is Jean Reno. That plot is the existence of Jean Reno.
Like, you don't need plot when the movie is carried by the sexual chemistry between Tom Cruise and what's her name? I'm messing up this joke now.
I was gonna say the sexual tension between Tom Cruise and the sweat on his own forehead.
Yeah. No, who plays Max?
Oh, I don't know. I'm super excited. I haven't seen the first Mission Impossible movie in probably like 10 years. I'm actually mad excited to watch it.
Wait. I don't remember the character of Max's name. You're not talking about John Voight, are you?
No, it's a woman who's like a 60-year-old like British John woman.
Voight. Oh, I was hoping you were going to say John Voight.
Yeah, me too. I mean, because they do have actually some legitimate chemistry in
that
movie.
They do in that movie. Yeah, there's a little bit of a mentor-mentee.
Vanessa Redgrave. Oh,
Okay, real quick, and I know that this should be on the movie, but I'm gonna forget it. I have I saw one of my favorite plays of all time, which is The Testament of Mary. It's a brilliant one act. Go look it up. It's genius and it's amazing. And Vanessa Redgrave came to see it because Blee Blorp was the star in it, who I'm forgetting, but it's this amazing character actress whose face I can see, but who I can't remember. And Vanessa Redgrave came to see her, and Vanessa Redgrave, I was waiting at the stage door because I wanted to tell this woman how great I thought she was. And then I see Vanessa Redgrave, all 5'4" of her, come up standing right next to me with her 6'7" jacked bodyguard.
That's Vanessa Redgrave from Zardoz, right?
Yes, exactly. Of Zardoz fame.
Hold on, no. And, Charlotte Rampling.
Oh, Charlotte Rampling, Zardoz. That's right. Yeah,
and
I get them confused a lot.
She, Vanessa Redgrave, turns to her manservant and is like, "May I?" And he gives her this sort of like fatherly look, and he hands her a cigarette, and she smokes. She takes about 3 drags of it and drops it on the ground, and ashed it on the ground, in just. It was like watching Shakespeare, watching this woman smoke a cigarette. But it was this beautiful moment where I was like, you can be one of the greatest living actresses of all time, which she is. She's astounding. And there is still going to come a time where some beefy man is going to be like, Vanessa, you can't smoke. You will die. Vanessa, you're allowed 3 puffs a day.
Is she alive still?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But she's like 98 or something. She's
still
really old.
She's also still acting. She's unreal. Vanessa Redgrave is astoundingly good.
That story reminds me a little bit of the Clickhole article about the little boy who wants to have a lady finger, a fig and lady finger.
Parfait
from McDonald's.
Yeah.
May I, Papa?
Okay, well, any parting thoughts?
We'll be back for Mission Impossible.
Yeah, thanks to everyone for listening.
With Charlotte Rampling.
Please like and subscribe and rate and review us. And we'll be back soon for a discussion on the classic Vanessa Redgrave, Charlotte Rampling joint, 1996's Mission Impossible.